We are at the Granley Bacon Resort in the midst of snow and extreme cold, and you with a cold. This is one of the Keystone Symposia on new insights into health span and diseases of aging from molecular to functional senescence. And we're with Judith Campisi. Judy Campisi with a cold.
Yes, sorry.
And you are a researcher into aging with a cold, now at the Buck Institute in Novartis, California. Novato, California. And also still at Lawrence Berkeley Lab.
Correct, okay. Correct.
Wherever I look, it's very easy for me to pick up a pile of things. Can we cure aging? On Discover magazine. Putting America's diet on a diet. This is Jamie Oliver going and repairing defective eating habits. Dietary restriction papers. Life is short if sweet. So in other words, be careful about how much glucose you're...
Yes.
You're getting glucose homeostasis, dietary restriction in fruit flies, Drosophila. Is that delayed aging or experimental artifact? Linda Partridge on the new biology of aging. Time magazine recently, why DNA isn't your destiny. So the new science of epigenetics, which comes into the whole aging field. Your own papers. I think a review article you did in Nature, in fact, used the word, discussed whether aging, there's a cure for aging.
Correct.
And so on.
Whether it was a mad
so
pursuit.
Let's start with that basic premise, which is aging a disease? We were sort of talking about this earlier.
I think it's a mistake to think about aging as a disease, as an entity that has a defined etiology and defined symptoms. But nobody dies of good health, right? People die of diseases. And what aging does is it sets the organism up to be vulnerable to really virtually all the major diseases that are seen in clinics today in the developed world. So aging is a process. And what it does is increase organismal vulnerability. And then we die mostly of disease. Although it's interesting, there are people who die and the pathologist will say, old age, multi-system failure or nothing really that stands out as being the cause of death. But aging is what happens to us that makes those diseases much, much more likely to occur.
So there is this term senescence, all right? So
yes.
This would be a breakdown in cells healthily replicating and so
yes.
on and so forth. This would be a distinctly different thing, I suppose, or is it at least a somewhat different thing from saying, can aging be put off almost indefinitely? Do we have a use-by date? And I can't get a consensus from people on this.
No, you won't. In the Nature article that you mentioned that we wrote with my colleague Jan Weich, we came to the conclusion that this is a question that cannot be answered. We simply don't know enough to be able to answer that question. So you can ask me what the stock market will be like 3 years from now, and I can give you an answer. And if you believe me, you're crazy. I think it's we simply don't know enough about aging. We don't know enough about what the prime drivers are, because until we can intervene in the prime drivers, we will continue to fight aging disease by disease by disease, which is what we're doing. And that's going to increase longevity, but that's not what you're getting at when you say, can we postpone aging indefinitely?
Right. So I think one thing needs to be made clear, and perhaps you could elaborate on this. The point I often make is if I go back to the writings of the great scientist statesman Francis Bacon, and we're back to this early 17th, late 16th centuries now. He was writing on disease and aging.
Correct.
A great
yes.
deal on aging.
Yes.
In books he was writing in 1610, 1619. So you think to yourself, gosh, if there was that kind of those kind of minds in the beginnings of the Royal Society and so on in 1660, we're already focused on that 400 almost 400 years ago, 350 mm-hmm. years ago. Why isn't this been sorted by now? And one of the answers would be this: simply, until you get genomic technology, you can't really even start looking in a detailed fashion at some of the underpinnings of this. Would that be accurate, do you think? So it's the technology that is allowing us to even really address this issue in a serious fashion. And then there's the baby boomer story, which is making it a pressing issue.
Yes, okay, so I agree. I think the reason why we can ask seriously now, is it possible to postpone, even for a short time, much less a long time, in humans, the aging process? I believe that the only reason why we can ask that as a serious question right now is because the science has now caught up with this very complex problem. So we have tools now to begin to ask that question. We still don't have an answer, but even in my career, I trained in cancer, and when I was a young student and postdoc, cancer was almost within our grasp. Of course, we haven't done very well with that, but still, it was almost within our grasp because of this, of the technology and the tools that we had. Aging was grinding up old and young rats and making measurements. And that's changed. That's completely changed. So now we can do genetic manipulations and pharmacological manipulations that will extend lifespan under very constrained experimental settings, but still, it's approachable. So I would say you're right that because we have technology now, we can begin to tackle this question, but I am not so sanguine that 40 years from now, we will have solved this problem. You know, Nixon declared war on cancer in the 60s. You know, here we are, you know, 50 years later, and we're still struggling with this disease.
Right, and this is a point that I've made to a number of people, which I think is that one of the dangers of you know, this vicious cycle, that to get the grant, you have to, the media has to sort of pat you on the head and say you're obviously doing great work and so on, and then there's a little bit of hype involved in that so that you can get the grant, and then if there's a failure to deliver in any way, shape or form, it looks like this science has failed or something. And this is the wrong impression and the wrong sense of what science is, which is this...
Actually, I disagree. So I think whenever I am interviewed by the media or whenever I'm being asked to comment on something in the media, the question always comes up, how will this fundamental finding, so let's say I'm talking about either something from my lab or someone else's lab that really gave us deep insight into an aging process or some part of the aging process, inevitably the media wants to know, how will this lead to a cure? Right. And when will that cure happen? I never have to answer those questions when I write a grant, because my peers know that that's a silly question and it's unanswerable. So I think the media is what's driving the hype of requiring that scientists explain their findings in terms of the future. I mean, how will this benefit a person in the future? It's not that we don't think about it. We think about it all the time. But for getting a grant, what you need to do is provide deep insights, and that's sufficient.
Right. I'm thinking about the kind of stories that actually do get into even the New York Times.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Glass of red wine, resveratrol.
Yes, yes.
Live longer.
Yes.
I think it's a little more complicated than that.
If the scientists who made those basic findings, especially if they have a financial interest, they have a company, right? So there, of course, there's another reason for promising something in the future, right? Investors want to know when it's going to pay off.
But how many of these pieces of advice make some sort of sense? I mean, so caloric restriction, CR,
yes,
as known, that seems to be reliably extending, on a first read, that seems to reliably extend life and health span.
Yes. So in many species, including some wild species, wild Drosophila, for example, caloric restriction will extend lifespan, and health span. So the calorically restricted flies aren't just sitting around with weak muscles. They're flying around and they're eating and they're, if you can believe a Drosophila's happy, they look happy. But it's not true that it works in all species. So for example, in wild mice, Steve Austat has published a study where in some wild mice it may have some benefit. In other wild mice, different ecological niche these mice were derived from, it does not seem to have a major benefit. And the other thing you should remember is that these calorically restricted animals are in a very protected environment. They're being raised in an animal house where mm-hmm. they have
special chow.
Exactly, and they have, you know, no predators. They don't have to adjust to swings of temperature. And I think it remains an open question as to whether caloric restriction would really be beneficial in the wild, even though people argue, and this argument makes sense to me, that the beneficial effects, the physiological changes that take place in animals when they're calorically restricted, may have evolved for just those kinds of swings of food and, you know, feast and famine that occur in the wild. Nonetheless, it's not clear to me that a chronically calorically restricted animal would do very well in the wild. So I think that's a question that remains open.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you. There was and again, you can't do just one thing.
So yes, that's right.
There are these effects, these multiple effects. This condition known as pleiotropy, where you're doing one
yes.
thing and having sometimes an antagonistic, an opposite effect.
Yes. Well, you know, during the meeting, you may remember that I think it was in George Martin's talk, he talked about how these single gene mutations that extend lifespan for quite some time in these model organisms may be acting on a particular pathway that has evolved so that those animals that show those great effects have an alternative lifestyle. They can go into diapause or go into, you know, dour. But and he brought up the fact that some of those mutants, when they're tested and in the laboratory for conditions that mimic the wild, so boom and bust of food, those mutants don't do very well. That was work done by Gordon Lithgow at the Buck Institute.
Right.
But Cynthia Kenyon replied, and I think this is a good point, that is true, that those mutants do not do well when food fluctuates. On the other hand, they do well when they're heat shocked or given another kind of stress. So a benefit may pertain to one set of stresses, but not another. So a calorically restricted animal may do well under a certain set of stresses and may do less well under a different set of stresses, cold stress, for example, as opposed to heat stress. So it's not so simple, and I know people would love it to be simple because then we just have a pill that makes us think we're calorically restricted and we're going to live longer and we're going to do well. And I think it's going to be more complicated than that.
Yes, in fact, I mentioned to a number of people here already, reminded them of this end of year, last year, 2009, December, paper in Nature from Linda Partridge's group, and a commentary here which notes that dietary restriction does indeed promote longevity. This we're talking about fruit flies,
mm-hmm.
But impairs fecundity, reproductive success, and so on. But when you tweak and fine-tune the amino acids in the diet, then you can, in fact, increase lifespan without loss of fecundity, at least in fruit flies. So it's a complicated story and
yes.
requires at least this kind of fine-tuning.
Yes, but what's wonderful is we do have the tools now to delve into this complexity. And I think this has been unprecedented in the history of aging research.
Yeah. So this is rather parallel to some extent to the conversations I've had with sleep researchers at sleep meetings, Sleep mm-hmm. 2009, we were at recently. And I made the same comment because Francis Bacon, ubiquitous Francis Bacon, in fact, had thought about these issues as well. And I was saying, well, how come we don't know what sleep is for? And one of the answers was that A, it's a complex question, but B, sleep research itself has only really taken
yes.
off in a serious, technologically
yes.
sophisticated fashion in very recent times. So these big issues that we think we ought to have the answers to now. Why do we sleep? Why do we age? Do we have a use-by date? In fact, are only recently addressable.
Correct. I agree. Yes.
Now, what kind of work are you working on? What are you doing at the moment? What kind of grants are you putting in for? and what's the climate like for getting money to do this?
Oh, the climate is terrible. Oh. Absolutely terrible. So we're all terrified. There's just not enough money for all of the talent that's out there.
Despite the enthusiasm for science from this administration?
Yes, yes. I think a major problem is that both the president and the Congress have a propensity to give money to science, but to try to direct it. And the greatest successes of science are first serendipity, and two, by letting talented scientists find their own way, define the questions and find their own way. I'll give you an example. The National Institute on Aging has four divisions. One of them is devoted to basic biology of aging, and one is devoted primarily to neuroscience. But the neuroscience division has a mandate from Congress to spend a certain percent of their budget on Alzheimer's disease. Okay. And this, you know, so this hamstrings the program officers who might see very promising areas that they wish to support, but when they have to spend some part of their budget on a specific disease, they're much less free to give money to promising new and maybe even risky types of grants. And the basic biology of aging is hamstrung because they don't own a disease. So no congressman is going to be inclined to give money to the basic biology of aging because that's not what their grandmother died from or their mother died from. Their mother died from cancer or Alzheimer's disease or stroke or whatever. So it's a problem. It's a very serious problem.
Let's just focus on this issue for a moment, because this notion of first of all, conveying to a larger audience how science is done and how science is most successfully done, and striking a balance between what you just said and the need for there to be this close, this relationship between science and society, between science and policy, and the policy makers. That's often at odds. There are obviously organizations that do fund, and have recently, there's been some recent changes as well, that fund the scientist. So the Howard Hughes Medical Institute funds the investigator.
Yes.
The Wellcome Institute in UK has recently stopped doing blanket institutional grants and is funding, in the same way, investigators.
Wonderful.
But which investigators do you choose? Well, you're likely to choose the ones who are already doing great work, aren't
you? Yes, which means it's a problem for the young scientists,
right.
Absolutely. And that's always a problem, right? You want to invest in someone with a track record, but how do you get somebody to get that track record? And so, actually, NIH is trying to do that. For example, there are now two pay lines. One, which is more generous to first-time investigators. Your first grant is going to be probably easier to get than your second grant. But it's always going to be a problem. And there are some institutions that are doing a better job of that than others.
Yeah. So what's exciting you at the moment? I mean, you've got a serious, distinguished career here in this whole field. So what's exciting you at the moment?
At the moment, what we are wildly excited about is we think we've found a mechanism, a basic cellular mechanism that links cancer, which is a disease of hyperproliferation. Cells get new functions, they do new things, and things they shouldn't do, of course, but gain new functions, with the degenerative diseases of aging, which is really loss of function. Things begin to fall apart. Your brain doesn't work as well. Your bones don't work as well. Your joints don't work as well. So for years, we've been asking, is it just an accident that cancer rises exponentially with age, starting at about age 50? By the way, so does cognitive decline, Alzheimer's disease, osteoporosis, type 2 diabetes, macular degeneration, blah, blah, blah. All those degenerative diseases and cancer, they all go up in parallel. So it could be a coincidence, or there could be some underlying biology. And so we think we have found at least one mechanism, underlying biological mechanism, that links those two very different age-related outcomes. And the irony is that we think what links them is the processes that have been put in place by evolution to keep us from getting cancer more often than we do. So it's a very ironic twist on evolutionary pressure to not get cancer.
So the question is, why on earth, at this particular, roughly this point, this turning point, does the body, does the entire system invest so much bioenergetic resources in destroying itself, almost? That's almost the question. Because it's making more of what you don't want, and making less of what you do need.
Well,
that was a rough
assumption. Yes, yes. So let me explain this, the mechanism, a little bit. So we think that when cells are in danger of becoming cancerous, they evolved a process that drives local inflammation. Right. So what the local inflammation does is it calls immune cells to the site of that damaged cell. Mm-hmm. It tries and often succeeds in eliminating that damaged cell and then stimulating local regeneration of the tissue. That's good. That's exactly what you want. You want that if a parasite invades you, mm-hmm. you want an inflammatory response to kill that organism and get rid of it. If a foreign body gets into your skin or gets into an organ, you want to seal it off, get it away. So inflammation is necessary for healthy life, especially in the wild where you're not protected from parasites and invading organisms and mechanical stress. What happens with age is that the system to eliminate cells that are driving this local inflammation is not 100% perfect. Well, it doesn't need to be 100% perfect because you're going to be, evolutionarily speaking, you're going to be dead by about the age 50 anyway. So there is no pressure to make these systems perfect. Same thing is true with DNA repair. There is no selective advantage to having perfect DNA repair. That would be very costly to do that, because you're probably going to be dead by the time it really matters. And of course, there's also the requirement that you have some background mutations to generate diversity, which will drive evolution. So when you're old, it is not that your body is investing in making things that are bad for you. It's that your body has simply accumulated enough things that were good for you when you're young that they're now bad for you when you're old. That's the whole concept of antagonistic pleiotropy. Very simply put, that's what it says. Things can be good for you when you're young, and the very same thing can be bad for you when you're old. Testosterone in men. Right. If you castrate a male, he'll never get BPH and he'll never get prostate cancer. But of course, he'll never reproduce either. So you need testosterone, but it's late in life. It can drive pathology, age-related pathology.
So, what are you suggesting? How are you going to address this?
Well, the key is understanding the mechanism, and understanding the mechanism has multiple layers. You just keep delving deeper and deeper. So we're now at a point where we understand the mechanism in broad strokes, that we can begin drilling down. The long-range goal would be to understand the mechanism of how these inflammatory milieu arise in sufficient detail to be able to design either small molecules or genetic interventions or dietary interventions that will ameliorate those processes. And whether we can completely eliminate them or simply tune them down is an open question. We need to understand much more than we do what the basic mechanisms are.
Let me go back to the point I made about investing in resources and just clarify a little bit what I was getting at. Because in talking to some people, they would be talking about the regenerative effects of, say, stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that there's less investment in stem cells. It's just that they end up banging their heads against a brick wall and mm-hmm. just get exhausted in the process. Mm-hmm. So those resources are still being directed, is what I was trying to say,
yes.
anyway, at a fix that is, in essence, you would say, natural selection has decreed that, or virtually decreed that there's no point at that point, because the organism is supposed to be on its way out at that point.
Tell me if this makes sense to you. Evolution tends to over-engineer for very good reasons, especially in a wild environment. When you're a hunter-gatherer, especially if you're a hunter, you're probably going to be injured multiple times, right? You want a vast store of stem cells so that you can absorb, and so you can absorb injuries and recover from injuries. Likewise, use of your muscles or bone or whatever. So evolution does tend to over-engineer. Still, it doesn't over-engineer so much that it becomes no longer advantageous to have an organism that could live for 300 years when chances are it's going to die when it's 50, right? So we are over-engineered. We do live to be 100, 120, even though for the most vast part of our evolutionary history, people over 50 were relatively rare. So what we're living on now is this over-engineering coupled to this buildup of damage that is no longer perfectly repaired or perfectly dealt with. So it's these two forces. So when we talk about extending lifespan, for example, indefinitely, we have to seriously consider how to improve a lot on evolution. Let me give you an example. There are some stem cells in the human body that probably can proliferate indefinitely because they have telomerase and they'll be able to extend their DNA, extend the ends of their telomeres indefinitely. There are other stem cells in the body that do not express telomerase, and so with each cell division, those telomeres shorten, and eventually they shorten so much they don't function, and that stem cell can't divide again. Most people don't die because those stem cells that lack telomerase have been exhausted. You still have plenty in your body, usually, when you die. You can take a skin biopsy from someone who's 100 years old and still get proliferating cells out of that biopsy. But what happens is the milieu, as those stem cells are aging, the local milieu is also changing. It's being subjected to damage and subjected to how cells respond to that damage. So even those proliferative cells are no longer in an environment that is conducive to their functioning optimally. And so it's these two things that are going on. There is an exhaustion of stem cells, but it's not that severe. But then there's the environment in which the stem cells are sitting that is degrading, and the two together are collaborating to make a functional decline. Now, there's a group, probably several groups, but one I know of in France that's been studying the stem cells, muscle stem cells, from extreme athletes. These are people who, you know, run triathlons or do triathlons as a hobby. And they have had long, long years, decades, of extraordinary demand on their muscles. In those people, they are now showing signs of stem cell exhaustion for the muscle. But you see, most people don't exercise to such extremes, and they can live to 100 and still have sufficient stem cell reserve for their muscles that they can regenerate a muscle. It may take longer, it may not be perfect, but the stem cells are there.
So is that almost saying that over-exercise can be fatal?
Sure. Just as Mae West said, too much is just enough, but that's not quite true in biology.
What about the other argument as well, that if you take a female sort of at past reproductive age, mm-hmm. then you could make an argument for saying that, fine, job's done. Mm-hmm. Somebody like Sarah Hurdy would argue that, in fact, with her grandmother hypothesis, that there is, in fact, a perfectly good reason for having that functionality extended because of the increase in fitness that is provided by
wisdom of the grandmother.
Well, and also, yes.
And the child and the rearing, helping
child
with the
rearing,
child rearing,
and so on
right.
and so forth. So
right.
Perhaps some of our ideas about what what the conditions are for closure were premature. In fact, that you know, maybe we do need to be around a lot longer than we thought.
That's very possible, but I think that's a different hypothesis.
Yes.
And I think that there has to be, we have to understand there's a distinction between aging, the degenerative changes, and the cancer that comes with age, and the idea that our longevity, even early in evolution, there may have been a benefit to having people with exceptional longevity, exceptional in those days, of course, probably being more 60 or 70 years of age. I think they're totally separate hypotheses. I cannot imagine how an allele could be selected for that caused your bones to fall apart and your joints to fall apart and your eyesight to go and your brain function to go. That's aging.
Right. Right. So in terms of advice that people, I've asked a lot of people about this. And despite the complexities of these papers that we read, a lot of the advice comes down to fairly the simple things, the sort of things that Michael Pollan puts in his book.
Oh, yes.
Food rules and
yes,
so on.
Yes, yes.
And I suppose my favorite abbreviation of it would be to say, keep your telomeres long and skip dessert. but how do you keep your telomeres long? What are the steps that... it's natural wisdom, some of it, isn't it?
Yeah. It's everything your mother told you to do. Eat your spinach, you know, don't eat too many sweets, don't smoke, exercise moderately. That's common sense. And what that will do probably, almost certainly, is keep you healthier longer. It's not clear to me that that will make you actually live longer, but it will certainly increase what we call health span.
Do you think that there is a limit on life?
Not a limit in the sense that there's some clock that's ticking, and you know, if you don't die prematurely, eventually that clock is going to hit some magic time, and you know, no human will live beyond that time. The idea of a maximum lifespan is really a population arc. It's like baseball statistics. You know, 40 years ago, this score or this performance was the top. Well, if you add another several hundred players into the mix, eventually somebody's going to beat that record and beat that record and beat that record. And it's true for humans. You know, the more humans there are, there will be people who will live longer than the longest lived person. But there are general biological limits. I mean, it's very unlikely we're going to ever engineer a mouse that will live 75 years. And I think it will be I think it's very unlikely that we will be able to engineer a human that will live 10,000 years. I think that's
but
not
what about
in the cards.
What about the social implications of some of these things? I mean, for example, when I talked to Tuck Finch, he was very concerned about the possibility that we would end up with health elites, that in fact prolonging life would be an expensive business, that only people with the resources could afford to do it. Therefore, you end up with this rather nasty inequalities.
Sure, that could happen. That's a problem for society. That's not a problem for scientists.
Here's another one from the New England Journal of Medicine, April 30th, 2009 perspective. Title is, this is from Kelly Brownell and Thomas Frieden. Ounces of Prevention, the Public Policy Case for Taxes on Sugared Beverages. So, it's been done with cigarettes, obviously.
Yes, yep.
Is there an argument for intruding into people's dietary preferences in this way?
Well, I can give you my opinion, but I think it's worth less than nothing. So my opinion is yes. I think we should tax cigarettes. I think we should tax alcohol. I'm a great wine lover, but I still think we should tax alcohol. We should tax sugar, and we should tax those things that, when taken at you know in excess, increase the burden you will place on society by getting one of these chronic diseases that's going to be very difficult to treat. The alternative is you triage people, or you have these horrible policies which say if you smoked and you get lung cancer, Medical society is not going to help you. I mean, these are all societal issues, and what I would hope for, and I think most people, at least in theory, would hope for, is a compassionate and egalitarian approach to health care and taking care of things. But this is not a science problem. This is, you can ask scientists their opinions, but my opinion is worth no more than, you know, the person who vacuums the rug in this room.
So what is the, I mean, since the Science Network is devoted to creating a public square, a sort of an agora for a discussion of issues and information about issues at the intersection of science and social policy, I would certainly argue that if you are going to make social policy, then it should at least be scientifically informed.
Sure. So taxing sugar and alcohol and cigarettes is scientifically informed. Taxing Brussels sprouts is not scientifically informed. The issue, though, is the question you posed. Should we tax food for the purpose of preventing chronic disease? That's a societal issue. That's a public policy issue. And it's a scientist's job is to inform, absolutely. But I think it's a mistake to think that scientists are better able to formulate policy than they are to advise the policymakers on what is scientifically sound. That's our job.
Okay, so if you were in charge of making policy about use of drugs, for example.
You're talking to a child of the 60s, please.
Then don't you think it'd be useful to get this, to sort of get the opinion of people who are experts in neuropharmacology?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
All right, so you just hinted a little bit about your background there. How did you get into science in the first place? Do you have a family that was scientific?
No.
What was the story here?
Oh, dear. My family doesn't have a lot of money, so I pretty much was knew I was going to go to a local college, and I also graduated from an all-female Catholic high school.
Where was this? Which part?
This was on Long Island, New York, and when it came time to choose a major, this college catalog listed all the men and all the women that were enrolled in that curriculum. So I chose the one with the most men. It's chemistry. It's pretty good. And I was pretty good at it. So that was a delight. I was actually having fun on both sides, socially and academically.
So chemistry was the beginning of it.
Right? Yeah. I trained in chemistry. And I was, as I said, I enjoyed it. I mean, I didn't really know that I would like science until I tried it, and I did like it.
So you didn't have a great science teacher or something like that?
No, wasn't one of those. Not really, no. Although, I mean, I've had some very influential mentors later in my career. I had a very great postdoctoral mentor. So I've been blessed with good people along the way. But serendipity, I sort of fell into it.
You mentioned cancer, so at some point you must have veered into sort of a medical direction.
I did. So my PhD was actually in biophysics, and I really wanted to learn some cell biology. It both intimidated me and intrigued me. And so when it came time to look for a postdoc, I looked for a postdoc that was more cell biological. And at the time, I thought cancer was curable, and I thought, maybe I can do that. I was pretty naive. And so I applied to join the lab of one of the really great fathers of the cell cycle, understanding how cells divide, which is at the heart of cancer.
Who was that?
His name was Art. His name is Arthur Pardee, and he's a wonderful, he was a wonderful mentor, a wonderful scientist, and is still has a wonderful mind.
Role of mentors is very important, particularly in science, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because they function as more than just a scientific figure. They're also patriarchs or matriarchs of families as well.
Yes, exactly. You become part of the family, and it's very influential in even in subtle ways that you don't realize.
When did you develop this interest in aging research?
You know, I, again, I fell into it totally serendipitously. I was a young faculty member at Boston University Medical School, and Richard Miller, who will be talking at this conference, was a little bit more senior to me, and he wanted to put together a program project on aging. He was working on aging. He was quite committed to aging. And you need at least three projects in a program project grant. And so there was a very talented dermatologist, chairman of dermatology, Barbara Gilchrist, and Richard Miller, who got together and decided to do this. And they looked around and said, who can we have for a third person? And actually, both of them I credit with getting me into aging. Mm-hmm. Because they came to me and they said, you know, there's this process where cells shut down dividing, and it probably has something to do with cancer. And I agreed. I thought at the time this was a mechanism for shutting down cells that were going to become cancerous. And they said, but you know, some people think it has something to do with aging. We're not convinced, but some people will buy this. And what do you think you can get interested in this problem? And I thought about it, and I thought, this is really interesting. I was studying how cells proliferate, but it's just as important to understand why they stop proliferating. So I joined their program project and proposed to do some things to see if it really related to aging. And as we started working on this, I realized, my God, this is important for aging. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of serendipitous. And so that's really how I got into it.
Is there anything else, I mean, as you look back now, is there anything else that you think you might have done if you'd not become a scientist?
Oh, you know, if you had asked me that question 25 years ago or 20 years ago, I might have come up with a realistic list of other things. You know, I've dabbled in becoming a folk singer or becoming a dancer or becoming a winemaker. But at this stage of my career, I honestly have lots of things that I think I would enjoy doing, but I'm not sure I would do anything that gives me such deep satisfaction as what I'm doing now.
Hmm. So, but the earlier winemaker might have been a possibility.
Yeah, I still flirt with that.
Oh well, you're still in the same field there. I mean, certainly the. Resveratrol and all those sorts of things is in the same area. What about? I ask a number of people who've been particularly influential in their lives. Who are amongst the smartest and the wisest people that they've encountered during their careers?
Well, certainly Art Pardee was very influential. I think in the way I run my own lab, for example, but. Even within the field of aging, I don't know if you heard George Martin's talk, but he has been an inspiration for I don't know how many generations of scientists. And in fact, it was George who helped me with this dilemma I was dealing with. I thought I was studying cancer, and now I think I'm studying aging, and how do I bring these two together? And he's always had this very wise, broad intellectual and evolutionary perspective on aging. And it was really discussing things with him and also reading some of his work that helped me put my own work into the larger picture. So I think he's been very influential to me personally, but also I think many young scientists. Yeah. Tuck Finch is another one who, you know, Tuck was talking about inflammation before the cytokines were even known. You know, he was a real pioneer in that way of thinking about underlying processes that could drive multiple diseases.
And with an adaptation, evolution.
Yes, also with a very strong evolutionary understanding.
Yeah. In his inaugural address, President Obama talked about restoring science to its rightful place. Didn't give any coordinates.
Yeah.
I've said to a number of people, this is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society, which could longest uninterrupted, arguably, science business on the planet. So it's a great celebration, great time to think about the place of science in society. So do you have any thoughts on what the rightful place of science is?
I do. I mean, I have thought about this. I think the duty of a scientist is to uncover the truth, no matter what it is. I don't think it is the duty of a scientist to decide how that knowledge will be used, although it is part, I think, of being a responsible scientist to point out both the dangers and the benefits of what that knowledge will do. That's the job, I think, or that is where I think science has to have a place in society, providing knowledge which will hopefully raise the standard of morality and living and capability of all humankind, but also advising society on the dangers and the benefits. I don't think it is the job of scientists, though, to legislate or to come down strongly on how this knowledge should be used. This is a societal problem. But scientists, of course, are part of society. We're also citizens, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to separate those two roles, the role of the knowledge giver and the advisor, and then the role of the citizen, where you may have very strong feelings about, you know, we should use what we've learned about splitting the atom for making energy, but not for making bombs, you know, this sort of thing.
Well, things have shifted. This is also the 60th anniversary of the National Science Foundation. National Science Foundation itself, the National Science Board, came out of a report that was originally asked for by Roosevelt and finally went to Truman. That was produced by a number of committees, really under the direct supervision of Vannevar Bush. And Bush and James Conant were then very powerful scientific advisors, but there was almost no oversight in those days. Mm-hmm. So we have now shifted to a situation where they produced very powerful results.
Yes.
To a situation now where all these things have to be very much more carefully done at committee levels and so on and so forth. So there's much more societal involvement.
Yeah, yeah. Some of it is appropriate, I think. For example, I do not many experiments, but I do experiments on mice. And as you know, if you want to work on a vertebrate animal, you have to propose what you're doing to a committee, and on that committee are people who are not scientists. You have to be able to justify what you're doing. I think that's actually very good. What I think scientists have not been very good at, and which would make it easier on them, is educating the non-scientific public about what we're doing and why we're doing it and why it's important. And I think there would be less committees and less burden on us if we were better at getting the message out of what we're doing and why.
Well, that's what we're trying to do.
I think what you're doing is terrific.
If you went back to your role as wine lover and winemaker, and you're putting on a dinner party, and you can have anybody from history.
Oh.
It's that question.
Oh dear. Oh dear. Yeah.
Who would you be particularly interested in having
goodness.
A conversation with?
I would probably start with Aristotle and end with Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, very interesting. Why Kurt Vonnegut?
Oh, he had such insight into contemporary society and is funny as hell. And sometimes you laugh hysterically at what he's written and you close the book and you want to cry. I think he was one of the great literary images in our society.
But I know you.
Everyone in between, yes.
I know you have to go shortly.
So oh, yes.
Let me ask you one last question. What are you optimistic about?
Oh, I'm optimistic that assuming people are take the advice of the pundits out there who say don't eat a lot of sugar and exercise moderately, that we're going to see a steady rise in health span. I don't know about lifespan, but definitely health span. I think the baby boomers, being the cohort that they are and being concerned about their health, I'm optimistic that we will have, you know, either through drugs or through lifestyle interventions, I think I'm going to have a healthier last 10 years of my life than, say, my grandmother did or my mother did. And I think most of us can look forward to that.
Okay. Judy Campisi, thanks very much.
My pleasure.